to the History for Atheists podcast. I'm Tim O'Neill, and I'm the author of the History for Atheists blog, where I analyse some of the things many of my fellow atheists get wrong about history in general, and the history of religion in particular. If you're an atheist, or just someone interested in common misconceptions and myths about history, this podcast is for you. Hello and welcome back to History for Atheists. My guest today is the historian of science, Tony Christie. Tony is an independent scholar based in Germany, and he's also the author of the superb Renaissance Mathematicus blog. Since 2009, Tony has been posting weekly on the history of science in the early modern period. His knowledge of this topic is absolutely vast, and he, like me, gets rather grumpy at pseudo-historical myths, especially the ones associated with Galileo. Since the Galileo affair is a topic that's often brought up in discussions about the history of science generally and the relationship between science and religion in particular, Tony is the perfect person to give us a detailed overview of what happened and, more importantly, what did not happen in the dispute between Galileo and the Catholic Church. Tony and I spoke for almost 2.5 hours on this subject, so I've edited our conversation into three parts of about 50 minutes each. In this, the first part, we discuss the common myths that seem to be accepted by many people and certainly by many atheists about what happened in the Galileo affair. Tony gives a detailed background to Galileo's early career and the social and scientific context in which he worked. In part two, we discuss Galileo's key astronomical discoveries, and then in part three, the causes of the controversy around his most famous book and his 1633 trial by the Inquisition. So sit back and enjoy this tour of 16th and early 17th century science with my guest, Tony Christie. Tony Christie, welcome to History for Atheists, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation about Galileo. But just to bring us into that conversation, I was reading online yesterday in preparation for this conversation with you, and I thought I'd go to a Reddit group devoted to atheists, and I typed in the search term Galileo, and here's what I discovered about Galileo. Apparently, Galileo was the father of science. Apparently, he was in many ways the first ever scientist. Apparently, he proved that the Earth went around the sun, and apparently the church rejected his scientific proof, refused to look through his telescope, and imprisoned him, tortured him, in some cases even burned him at the stake because they hated science. But he was right and they were wrong, and the church took until 1992 to finally get around to apologising for oppressing him or perhaps burning him. How accurate is that picture of Galileo that I picked up by reading Atheists Online yesterday?
Let's put it this way. The only bit of it that's halfway true is 1992, which is when the point where the Pope announced the decision of the commission that had been set up to investigate the Galileo affair and basically said, well, what we did was not right. And that's about as far as it got. The rest of it's rubbish. Okay. There's a sort of, if we look at Galileo, if you ask people who's the most famous scientist, these days you'll get an answer. You'll get some sort of television personality. You'll get, if it's Americans, they'll say Neil deGrasse Tyson. If it's Brits, they'll say Brian Cox. I have no idea what the Australian equivalent of that is, but television personalities, not really practicing scientists. Maybe David Attenborough, who's not even a scientist. I mean, Brian Cox at least was a scientist, is a scientist. Neil deGrasse Tyson was at one point in his life an astronomer or an astrophysicist or something, hasn't been for a long time. But if you press it and say, well, who is a famous scientist? Who is the most famous scientist? And you usually get three people named. Interestingly, they're all physicists. That's Galileo, Newton and Einstein. You might get Darwin thrown into the mix, and that's about it. But if you then ask them what they know about Galileo, What they will tell you is 50% legend, 50% myth, and 100% bullshit. And it's what's interesting, you'll get almost exactly the same proportions about Newton or Einstein. The bigger, the more important, the bigger the figure historically, the less truth in the popular image of that person. And Galileo suffers immensely from this. The myth that the Galileo, that the people that think they know about, was created end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. As you well know, there was a sort of this thesis from various American university or college professors who invented this war between science and religion. Yep. And Galileo became the main witness for the prosecution. And they created the Galileo myths. He wasn't that important in the 18th century or after his death in the 17th century as a scientist. So it's very difficult because even books, and the trouble is most of the books on Galileo are written by philosophers, not historians. And what they do is that Galileo is immensely readable. He's one of the greatest writers in the history of science. He's a brilliant polemicist. And they read Galileo, but they don't do the science. They don't do the background. They don't look at it in context. They read Galileo straight. Like they take his book, they'll take something like, I've got it in one of the translations in front of me, The Two New Sciences. They'll take it and they'll read it. And they'll try to create their picture of what's happening just by reading Galileo. They don't read the rest. I mean, it's just they don't look at it in context because they're not historians, they're philosophers.
So they're literally basing it on one side of the argument because there was an argument. And secondly, yeah, they're basing it on the writings of a guy who was very good at promoting his side of the argument. He was a great polemicist. I mean, leaving aside
In the 17th century, you have the same thing with Francis Bacon. Yeah. Bacon's influence on the history of science is much, much smaller than most people think. And most of what he said was wrong. But he's a brilliant writer. Right. And he even wrote a science fiction story, you know, and everybody thinks he's wonderful. So he gets bigged up by the philosophers. And the philosophers originally wrote History of Science. Philosophy of Science is much older than History of Science in the modern context. So you've got the philosophers in the 19th century are writing the history of science, and they tend to read the people who can write philosophically, like Galileo, like Bacon, to a lesser extent Newton, and they build their story around this.
Yeah. So if Galileo was elevated, if we could say it that way, in the 19th century, as a result,
late 18th, late
as a result, 18th, early 18th 19th century. As a result, in terms of the modern conception of him, in large part of the Draper-White thesis, the conflict thesis, the idea that science and religion has always been a war, which arose in the 1870s to 1890s. Maybe if we can go back and have a look at, if you can tell us about Galileo's reputation in his time, in the early 17th century, what was his standing in that period?
Well, one thing that most people don't realise is that Galileo was also already a fairly old middle-aged man before anybody really knew he existed. He was a North Italian academic. He didn't have a degree. He got to be a professor on the basis of his abilities and on personal recommendations. Interesting enough, he got his first job on the recommendation of a cardinal of the Catholic Church, who was the house cardinal of the Medicis, Del Monte. And Guibaldo Del Monte was one of the leading sort of mathematical engineer physicists of the time, and his brother was the Medici cardinal, and Galileo sent his stuff, his mathematical stuff, to Del Monte to Guibaldo, and he sort of said to his brother, "Oh, this guy's good. You've got to give him a professorship in Pisa."
So the idea that the Catholic Church was made up entirely of superstitious idiots who hated science and had no scientific knowledge is clearly nonsense, given that Galileo was being recommended to by a cardinal who was highly scientifically literate.
One of the things that really annoys me is the fact that people sort of say, "Well, yeah, no, it's the Jesuits. They had it in for Galileo, and they're completely anti-science." The leading mathematical scholars of the period are all Jesuits. Mathematics played no really major role in the medieval university. Nominally, quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy was part of the undergraduate course at university, liberal arts course, but wasn't actually taught very much. If it was taught, it was taught at a very low level. The arithmetic was Boethius, which is this sort of one and one is two and sort of stuff like this. No joke.
I've read it,
The music was also Boethius, and in mathematical terms is the theory of proportions, because length of strings, sort of double the length of string, you get an octave and all the rest of it, is Pythagoras. Geometry, they did the six books of the first six books of Euclid, but in fact, very often they didn't get much past the first book. And astronomy was Sacro Bosco, which is a sort of non-technical introduction to geocentric astronomy, and that's it. I mean, that's the mathematics taught at the medieval university. I mean, don't forget that Galileo was taught at a medieval university. The university system is still medieval at the end of the 17th century.
Was that Pisa or Verona? I'm trying to remember.
He was at Pisa at the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then went to Padua.
Yep.
Again, on the recommendation of Del Monte, and that's the point, Christoph Clavius, who was the professor of mathematics for the Jesuits at the Collegio Romano, which is now the Jesuit University in Rome.
And in this period, mathematics included astronomy, didn't it?
Astronomy is a branch of mathematics. And one of the people who changed this for the Catholic Church was Clavius. The Jesuits set up a major education program. Their argument was their counter-reformation, and their argument is we can't defeat the reformers just by telling them that they're wrong. We have to have the better arguments. So they set up an education program to teach their own people and to teach Catholics better knowledge and better methods of arguing than the Protestants. We're going to beat them on the intellectual level. And this is the whole point of the Jesuit education program. And originally, it's very Thomist. It's very Aristotelian Thomist, sort of medieval stuff, but modernized. And there's no mathematics in it, really. And Clavius comes along. Clavius is the professor of mathematics at the Collegio Romano. And so they said, we need a major mathematics program. And various people in the Jesuits say, no, we don't. So Clavius fought a sort of 10-year war and won, and got mathematics installed in all of the Jesuit schools and colleges throughout Europe. And by the early 17th century, there are literally tens of thousands of them. And he ran a teacher training scheme. So he taught the first generation of teachers himself, wrote the textbooks. And basically introduced modern mathematics for that period, modern mathematics, into the Catholic curriculum. And he's doing this. And Galileo goes to Clavius the same way he went to Guibaldoldo and Del Monte and says, hey, can you recommend me? You know, like sort of, I'm a mathematician, I'm quite good. You know, like sort of.
And wasn't Galileo originally taught mathematics by Jesuits?
Not really, no. Oh, okay. he, He was taught by a private tutor. I forgot his name. Ritchie, I think. It doesn't matter. He originally went to university in Pisa to study medicine because his father wanted him to have a good career.
But didn't get a degree in the end.
He dropped out. Yeah. He didn't like it. And he took private mathematics lessons by this guy who had a good reputation as a mathematician. And word got around that he was pretty good. And that's when he started getting in contact with people like Del Monte and Clavius. He wrote a couple of papers, one of them on his theories about what, in fact, Archimedes had done when he was measuring up whether the crown was gold or not. He introduced a new... No, he looked at the physics of it and said the traditional story can't work. How did it really work? And invented a hydraulic scales, a theoretical one. And that was that impressed Del Monte and it impressed Clavius. Yeah. And they recommended him, they gave him references to get the university jobs. But Clavius set up this whole academic mathematics thing for the Catholic education system. And interestingly enough, in the Collegio Romano, he set up an advanced institute for mathematics. And he had some very, very good people working there. Like he selected all the best Jesuit mathematicians he could find. And they were running research programs and doing all the rest of it. So they are the most advanced mathematicians in Europe at the time.
They're not superstitious idiots.
So this is not anti-science in any way whatsoever. It's exact opposite, which is why Galileo turned to Clavius, because he knew where the people in the nowhere were. He went to Pisa as professor of mathematics. Basically got thrown out because he's always been a clever arsehole and enjoyed taking the piss out of people. And whatever you say about Galileo, he was incredibly intelligent. And
the impression I get is that he was a very, very smart guy. He loved an argument. And he was very good at taking the piss and probably annoying people. He probably would have made him into a Twitter troll, I think.
And he's a polymath. He was a good mathematician. He was a very good artist, which played a role because he was the first person to recognize that what he saw through the telescope was the surface of the moon was three-dimensional. And the theory is that because he'd been trained as an artist, he could recognize shadows and the rest of it. He then went off to Padua, where he stayed for quite a long time. And he's the professor of mathematics. And you have to understand, in the hierarchy of the medieval university, the professor of mathematics is at the very bottom of the heap. He's the least important person at university, literally. And some universities, probably the cleaning woman has more status than the professor of mathematics. And so Galileo said, but he establishes himself in intellectual circles in Padua as a good drinking companion, as a wit, clever clogs. He's the soul of the boogieing. But he's a nobody. He actually then gets a summer job, summer vacation job. The heir to the Medicis, mathematics. He's employed by the Grand Duchess Christiana as maths teacher to her son. As I say, he'd been in Padua for quite a long time, had a local reputation, but that's about it. Had already done his stuff in mechanics with his ramps and his balls and the laws of fall, but hadn't written it up and hadn't published it. And then along comes the telescope. And there is one of the oldest myths is that Galileo invented the telescope. That actually started in his own lifetime, that he claimed to have invented the telescope, which he denied. He said, I never made this claim. And of course, he didn't invent the telescope. The other one was that he vastly improved the telescope basically his telescope is no different to the one that was invented by Lippershey in 1608. What it had was better lenses, different focal lengths. But a lot of other people had done that anyway. And what Galileo had done was not particularly spectacular or anything else. He sort of started, he was actually a very, very good astronomical observer. You can't deny that. He was an excellent astronomical observer. And he started doing basic sort of observations. He started doing his sketches of the moon and all the rest of it. And then he discovered the four moons of Jupiter.
Was this, had he already decided that he agreed with Copernicus, or was that what got him to the point where he was considering himself?
Well, the interesting thing is that Kepler published in 1596, his Mysterium Cosmographicum, which is a rather weird book in which he proves that the spaces between the six planets are the five regular Euclidean solids, which is a brilliant piece of mathematics, but it's sort of rather weird.
Completely wrong.
It's still and the story is that he sent one to Galileo, which is complete rubbish. He didn't, because he didn't know who Galileo was. Nobody knew who Galileo was. What happens? He gave a friend who went on a tour of Italy, he gave him two copies, and said, "If you meet anybody interesting along the way who might be interested in it, give him one." So his friend went all the way down to Rome. And still had the books, and was on his way back to Germany, and he stopped off in Padua and suddenly realised he still had these two books, and sort of went into the university and says, "Is there a professor of mathematics around here?" And sort of found Galileo and gave him the two books and said, "Yeah, like, you might be interested in this," and sort of went on his way. Galileo looks interesting, and she wrote a letter to Kepler, thanking him for the books and saying that he had been a Copernican for a long time, but didn't talk about it in public. And Kepler wrote back saying, "Well, you should talk about it in public. We've got to promote Copernicus." And that was the end of the correspondence.
What year
didn't that, respond.
What year was that?
This is sort of towards the end of the 16th century,
yeah.
around 1600 or so, maybe a bit earlier. And that was the end of the correspondence, and Galileo didn't respond to Kepler's letter. Kepler describes this as there's a strange man who's got two names the same, because in Latin, Galileo Galileo is Galileus Galileus. and that was the first sort of contact between the two of them. And Galileo had never really done anything very much about it in those terms at all. He never really sort of said, "I'm Copernican," or "I'm a geocentric," or whatever. 1604, there was a stellar nova, which Galileo missed the beginnings of.
Supernova. Supernova, yeah.
Yeah. Kepler wrote a report on it, wrote and published a report on it, observed it. Simon Marius and another student in, Simon Marius was a student at the time, and another student in Padua, Simon Marius was a student in Padua, sort of basically took the piss out of Galileo because he missed it. And Galileo then held a series of lectures on it. So he's starting to get, because you have this thing about the nova, it's the disproved part of the Aristotelian cosmology. Yep. And what you have to understand, most people don't realize, people talk about there being a fixed astronomy. They sort of say geocentric astronomy. What you have as mainstream and it's important. This is mainstream. There are other versions. It's an uneasy compromise between Aristotelian cosmology and Ptolemaic astronomy. And uneasy compromise, well, one of the central points of Aristotelian cosmology is that everything rotates around a common center. It's homocentric. And the deferent epicycle model of Ptolemaic astronomy contradicts this, because they don't. I mean, the planets go around a little thing which goes around a thing which isn't centered on the Earth, and yeah.
So it's what I often refer to as a series of mathematical kludges. It's basically, well, how do we maintain this idea generally?
It's lots of circular orbits,
but still describe what's going on in the sky.
It's interesting. It's Fourier analysis. You can reduce everything to a set of circles. And Fourier lived in the 19th century, so you're like, they're way ahead of their time, boy. And so you got this uneasy compromise. And all the way through the 16th century, people have been poking holes in Aristotelian cosmology, because another central tenet of cosmology, of Aristotelian cosmology, is that there's a difference between the sublunar region and the supralunar region. That's the orbit of the moon divides the Earth from outer space. And everything under the orbit of the moon consists of four elements. It's a region which changes the whole time. Everything above the moon consists of one fifth element, the quintessence, which is literally the fifth element. Most people don't realize the origin of this word. The ether, yep. It's another. Yeah. Yep. And this is unchanging. Movement on the Earth. Natural movement is vertical movement from things fall down to the Earth. All other forms of movement are unnatural movement. And in the supralunar region, you only have natural movement, and natural movement is circular. It's uniform circular motion. And if you actually look at the planets from the Earth, they don't go around in uniform circles. And trying to explain this, you produce various mathematical models. The first one is with nested spheres. So you have one sphere going around that way and another one going around that way, which the one is inside the other, in order to produce the variations in the planetary motions. And this is the model that Aristotle adopted. In Aristotle, you end up with, I think it's 57 spheres to get it to work. There are two other models which were developed by Apollonius, and they are the excentric model, that you just move a circle away from the center, and the other is the epicycle deferent model. And basically, Ptolemaic astronomy uses the epicycle deferent model, but modifies it in order to produce a uniform circular motion using equants and all that. We don't need to go into the details, but it's a fairly complex but it works. It works because
you can use it to work out where something is going to be in the sky at any given time. Was there an understanding that this couldn't possibly be what was really going on? And the reason I'm asking is I'm interested in whether Galileo thought that the Copernican model, which was in many ways also a series of mathematical kludges, because it involves circular orbits and the orbits aren't circular, did he really think that that was what was really going on in the sky?
Yes.
He did.
It's interesting because there is a cosmology from Ptolemaeus, from Ptolemy, as the English say. I prefer the German Latin version, Ptolemaeus. There is a method in which he embeds the epicycle deferent models in spheres. And this appears in the work of Peuerbach. When at least everybody thought originally Peuerbach is still 15th century. One of the two most important 15th century astronomers. And everybody thought this was original to Peuerbach, but it turns out to be there is a one which was discovered in the 1960s, one Arabic manuscript of Ptolemaeus's cosmology. And this is exactly the model that's in there. So obviously Peuerbach had one. And if you actually read Ptolemy, it's always said that Ptolemy is just sort of mathematical models and it's not the truth. But if you actually read his big, what is called in English, the Almagest, the Syntaxis Mathematicae, he actually believes in his model. It's real. People ignore this and say, no, it's just a mathematical model. And they say that he's an Aristotelian. He's not. Ptolemy has a very interesting mathematical philosophy, which gets ignored. There are a couple of very good books on it, but they're very technical. So we won't go into that. So you've got this model, and there are competing models. This is the next point. Yeah. You have in the 16th century, you have a return to the Aristotelian homocentric model with Fra Castoro, who is an important figure. He's a physician and an astronomer, astrologer. He's the guy who actually gave syphilis its name. He's an interesting historical figure.
Yeah.
And he out of purity, he rejects the Ptolemaic model and says, we've got to go back to Aristotelian homocentricity. It's purity. It's back to the cosmology. And when Clavius is writing his Sphero, which became the most important teaching book on astronomy at the end of the 16th century, he regards Fra Castoro as a far more serious opponent than Copernicus. This is. You also still have there's a model from which first appears in the work of Martianus Capella in the 5th century, in which Venus and Mercury orbit the Sun, and the Sun orbits the Earth with the rest of the planets. This is often called the Egyptian model or the Heraclidean model. Heraclitus had nothing to do with it. And the way that Capella talks about it, it's obviously not new. So there were previous people who had this. And this model was actually very, very popular in the Middle Ages. And it's very logical because if you look at it, Mercury and Venus never go very far away from the Sun, which is why you have this phenomenon with Venus as the morning star and the evening star. It depends on which side of the Sun it is, because it orbits the Sun. Yeah? It very obviously orbits the Sun. And Mercury, which is inside the orbit of Venus, but not so good to see, also very obviously orbits the Sun. And people realize this very early on. And so you have this alternative, the Capellan model. You also have doing the rounds all the way through. You have a Heraclidean model, which is basically a normal geocentric model, except for the Earth has the owner rotation. It moves. It rotates. And this was also discussed particularly in the Middle Ages. Lots of the leading medieval philosophers discussed this model and all said it's much more rational that the Earth rotates and not the sphere of the stars, which is enormous. Yeah. And then said, but convention or tradition dictates it's others, so we won't use it.
Oresme and Buridan,
they're all looking at this and sort of rejecting it, but rejecting it on sort of traditional grounds, not on physical grounds. On physical grounds, they accept it as being a much more rational model. So the convention that there is sort of geocentric astronomy on the one side, heliocentric on the other. It's far too simplistic.
Yeah. But is that misapprehension of a dichotomy, is that due to Galileo? Because Galileo...
No, it goes back several hundred years. You're talking about development which goes over a period of 200 years. You're talking about
But I was thinking of the fact that when Galileo wrote his dialogue, it was a dialogue. It was between two world systems. He ignored all those other alternatives. He doesn't talk about the Tychonian system. He doesn't talk about any of the ones you just talked about.
He actually bullshits because when he wrote the Dialogo, both of the systems he discussed had been abandoned.
Right.
The systems, what he should have been talking about, would have been a Tychonic system in which all the planets go around the sun and the sun goes around the Earth, yep, with or without diurnal rotation. There are two different models. Or a Keplerian model. And the two systems that he discusses were both obsolete by the time he discusses them. So he's setting up a polemic, which is complete bullshit. You know, I mean, it's Galileo at his most polemic. I'm going to be right, and everybody else is wrong. Yeah.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves because that was I introduced that because that was the 1930s. We're not that
mainstream. Mainstream was we have a Ptolemaic geocentric system, and we have as major competitor at the beginning, but not taken very seriously by anybody really, Copernicus' heliocentric system. Then the Tychonic system gets introduced by Tycho Brahe, but he's not the only one. There's a whole series of people who come up with this model based on a modification of a Copernican system and thinking about the Capellan system. They start with the Capellan system and say, well, what if all the planets orbit the sun? And it's a natural next step. And Tycho is not the only person who does this. There are quite a few of them. But it's one of the fascinating things about this whole story is that it's whoever publishes gets the credit, you know, like sort of publish or perish. You know, it's not different in modern things. So like we've got Tycho's system and we got Copernicus's system, and then along comes Kepler. And Kepler in 1609 publishes his Astronomy Nova, in which he produces the first of his two planetary laws, that the orbits are in fact ellipses and that the Earth is at the focal point of the sun rather is at the focal point of the ellipse.
Yep.
He actually only proves it for Mars. But assumes it for all planets. he never actually bothers to do the work on the rest.
But can I go back to a point you just touched on? Because I think this is very important. You said barely anyone took Copernicus seriously. And if you read a lot of popular modern discourse on this, you would think that it was like evolution versus creation, that on one side you had the scientists and they all believed in Copernicanism, and on the other side you had the superstitious, stupid Catholics, the Inquisition and so on, who rejected it and believed in the Ptolemaic system. But it was nothing like that. So going back to your point, you know, my understanding is that there was only a handful of scholars who accepted Copernicanism at the beginning of the 17th century. So at the time that Galileo first started to get into trouble, there was barely anyone who actually accepted.
It's almost, if you go up to 1600, there's a famous footnote from Robert Westman, that there are only 10 Copernicans in the world between 1543, when De Revolutionibus was published in Nuremberg, which is down the road from where I'm sitting now. Yeah. The house is still there. I can see it on my blog. It's actually what my blog banner is. It's this house where the De Revolutionibus was printed.
Yeah.
Robert Westman says there are 10 Copernicans in the world between 1543 and 1600. There are actually a couple more. He misses some. But there is actually a modern research, if you really go into it, there's a very wide spectrum of people accepting bits of Copernicus, accepting aspects of it, rejecting, discussing, and so forth. There's a very good book by Pietro Oldomeo, which goes into all of this. Which I highly recommend.
I've read it. It's a great book, and I think you might not recall, but on my blog, you and I had a debate with a commenter who was taking issue with me over this,
And you very kindly came in my support, quoting both Westman and Amadeo, saying, look, here they are. Like, I think we came up with a total of maybe 12, but one of those actually changed his mind. So it's kind of like 11.
Now, what is this sort of...
The point is barely anyone actually accepted
They found it... People found it an interesting mathematical model. And one of the things that did happen was the planet... We need to go back, all the way back to Ptolemy. What is the purpose of astronomy? The astronomy is... we said his models work. The purpose of astronomy is to say where planets are at a given point in time. And the usage there for that is astrology. You also need it for navigation. You need it for cartography and so forth. So astronomy is actually a sub-discipline which provides data for other academic disciplines. And the tables that were based on Ptolemy were incredibly inaccurate because, like, Ptolemaic tables had been copied from manuscript to manuscript to manuscript over 2,000 years, which meant they had a lot of errors in them. They were never very accurate in the first place. They were accurate, okay, but, you know, and they got worse and worse. And so the reform, and this is one of the things that was going on, and this is where Copernicus first got into it. The reform is to try and get better tables. The first people to do this Rigamontanus and Peuerbach in the 16th century. And Copernicus learned his astronomy from the textbooks of Peuerbach, one of which Rigamontanus published. He set up the first scientific printing press. So, like, this process has been going on for about 200 years. And what the people are really into is getting more accurate astronomy. And the principal drive behind that is in order to get more accurate astrology. Kepler is an astrologer, Galileo is an astrologer. Copernicus is the notable exception. He does some minor astrological stuff. He interprets a couple of horoscopes of people. He's a doctor. He's a physician. He does some of his stuff. He does as a physician. It's very obvious astrological medicine, which is the mainstream medicine at the time. What the main interest in this is not in models of explaining the universe or anything else. It's getting data. And people hoped that Copernicus, because he had a new mathematical model, would deliver better data than the Ptolemaic model. So people were using it instrumentally. It's what Westman, not West, you know, is Westman, calls the
Gingrich. Gingrich, right?
Wittenberg model.
Yeah.
No, but Westman calls it the Wittenberg model because they're using it instrumentally. Yep. And people produce so-called ephemerides based on Copernicus. And it turns out they're just as inaccurate as the ones because they're using the same basic data. And this is where Rigamontanus in the 15th century set up a program to get new basic data. And unfortunately, he died before he could even get going. And the project got forgotten. And this is where Tycho Brahe comes in. Tycho Brahe is a Danish aristocrat who's interested in astronomy, mathematics. And he wants to observe a solar eclipse or something and realizes all of the tables, depending on whether they're Copernican or Ptolemaic, are both completely inaccurate. So he sets up his life's aim is to produce new data, to produce new tables. And this is exactly what he does. He spends 30 years producing astronomical data that is on several factors more accurate than anything the Greeks ever produced, right. Vast amounts of it. And at the end of his life, although he didn't intend it to be the end of his life, at the end of his life, he employs Kepler to turn this data into a astronomical model, and he wants him to turn it into his Tychonic model, and gets him to give a deathbed promise that he'll do this. And Kepler does exactly the opposite. He turns it into the Keplerian model. And what is important, there's quite an interesting thing, mathematical scientific thing. For the mathematical tools that Kepler is using, the accuracy that Tycho had produced is adequate, but if it had been more accurate or less accurate, Kepler wouldn't have been able to derive his model from it. If it'd been more accurate, because they're not actually ellipses, they're sort of fucked ellipses, you know. Right? So, and because it had exactly the right level of accuracy, that Kepler could deduce that the orbit of Mars is an ellipse.
Yeah.
It took him 6 years to do so, and he kept backtracking. He actually came up with a model which wasn't an ellipse, but which was much more accurate than anything that had ever been produced before. But he said it didn't do justice to the accuracy of Tycho's observations. So he started from scratch again. Kepler is a bulldog. Yeah. Incredible. People don't realize Kepler wrote 83 books and pamphlets in his life, wrote and published.
Wow.
I mean, you learn at school, all you learn at school is Kepler, three planetary cassettes, laws, and that's it. Yeah, like, this guy is. If anybody is the father of modern science, it's Kepler. It's not Galileo. He did more than Galileo ever did.
I've often said that one of the worst things about the popular myths about Galileo is that it edges Kepler out of the story. Kepler was the only guy who got it right. I mean, close to right. and you never hear about him. It's ridiculous. And Galileo completely ignored him. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah, because Galileo doesn't want to share the credit with anybody. This is the very important point.
Galileo has
the ego of an out of control Arctic truck, and he is not prepared to share credit with anybody on any level whatsoever.
Well, that brings us to the end of part one of my conversation with Tony Christie. In part two, we will take up the story of Galileo's sudden rise to fame and the first controversy about his teaching of the Copernican model as fact. So I'd encourage you to check that out next. See you again here soon. This has been another History for Atheists podcast. If you've enjoyed this show, please subscribe today. You can also subscribe to the History for Atheists YouTube channel for video versions of this and other shows, or to the original History for Atheists blog for an even more extensive collection of detailed articles on how to avoid errors about religious history. Have a great day.